Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castorbis podcast with a K, available on castorbis.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Bonjour, je suis Christian Crawley et je suis l'éditeur de castorbis.com. Avec moi, comme jamais sans, Brian Turnover et James McLean. Guys, it's Bastille Day.
I would never have guessed.
Yes, and this is obviously a massive cultural celebration. Every year in France, every July the 14th is Bastille Day, and the all of Europe goes entirely mad for Bastille Day.
Is he still speaking French?
No, I'm not.
Well, it's Northern, isn't it?
It's Northern, yeah. I'm speaking Northern. I am of course satirising the insane sycophancy that surrounds American Independence Day here in the UK. The point of American Independence Day, dear listener, is that we don't give a damn about American Independence Day. That's the whole point of it. So, in this week's Castorbis podcast with a K, we'll be completely ignoring Bastille Day and American Independence Day, but we will be possibly discussing such interesting questions as, does the Doctor use his sonic screwdriver to shave? Or maybe we won't, but perhaps we will talk to Brian and James. Chaps.
Is he still talking French, or is this Northern again?
I don't know. I'm figuring that out myself. Does this mean that we're only going to be talking about episodes of Doctor Who that take place in France? Is that happening? We're not doing that, right?
We could have done that. We could have talked about Reign of Terror and City of Death, but we probably won't. No. No, we've got a lot more things to talk about than that, haven't we, after all?
And Girl in the Fireplace.
And the Girl in the Fireplace.
Oh, very
so
good.
Now what we've done is we've just talked about them. So that's our quota.
Clockwork Men as well. Which is a possible link to Series 8.
Really?
If the trailer's anything to go by. Indeed. So, dear listener, you must have seen the cast... God's sake, I've taken over the TV show now. You must have seen the Doctor Who trailer last night. I've seen it since it was first broadcast during halftime of the World Cup, which is a very clever move by the BBC. I suspect that's the most Doctor Who fans who have ever tuned in for a World Cup final since 1966.
James. I was actually watching the World Cup final, and then it was interrupted by a stupid Doctor Who trailer.
It wasn't a stupid Doctor Who trailer, was it? It was a very interesting and intriguing Doctor Who trailer, Doctor Who season trailers go.
I thought it was quite explicit, since we've still got 6 weeks to go. I mean, I know...
I didn't notice those bits.
There's a vast proportion of fans have, of course, already seen most of Series 8 by now. But for the rest of us, I thought it was actually quite indulgent for being 6 weeks ahead. Not that I can remember how indulgent they were for the previous ones. Maybe I'm just used to the Day of the Doctor being so held back until very close that I'm not used to this sort of... detail.
I mean, it's over a month, isn't it? We're looking at a month and a week, or a month.
Five weeks or so.
It's way to go. Yeah, Brian, you've seen the trailer?
I have. Yeah.
What do you think?
I liked it. It was fun. I have to say though, there's something I've noticed with the trailers anymore. As much as I like having them and enjoy watching them, they're not getting me any more excited for the show than I already am. And I think that's because, like I've said before, for the first time in a long time, I'm extremely excited because I'm really dying to see what Peter Capaldi does with it.
Yeah.
But it's such a weird thing. It was like, I watched the trailer and I was like, that was fun, but it didn't have me any more pumped. But it was a good trailer. Lots of good stuff in it. And it made me realize another thing, that I am done trying to figure out the Doctor's age. I'm over that. Because that's just ridiculous. And we're going back into Pertwee territory now with the thousands of years old thing. So I'm just done with that. I don't care. You know what? He's an old guy. That's all that matters.
The old guy.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it was fairly close because he was well over 1,000 by the end of his era. And then, of course, he had his hundreds of years on Trenzlor. So he probably is about 2,000.
Wasn't it? I think.
Because it was only almost like the same lifetime over. I was thinking that's a bit indulgent for one story to just eat up the whole lifetime again in one space. It just seemed a bit to me anyway. But yes, I suppose 2000 is close. Hi. So what did you think, Christian, since we never asked later?
I was thrilled by it. I liked seeing things that I hadn't seen before because I've been kind of, you know, it's very tricky, as we've discussed on many occasions before, in keeping the spoilers away when you're running a Doctor Who website. But I have, thanks to my news team, I've been able to, and having Phil as assistant editor, I've been able to push some things away. So that guy with a steel head and... that other scary guy, they were particularly interesting. I'm intrigued by some of the dialogue. I think it might have been chopped up a bit. I don't think I'm not entirely sure. Well, we don't know what's going on until we see it, do we? But you know, like, they're clever with trailers and how they mix and match dialogue, and then we find out that they're completely unrelated. So mm-hmm. I'm interested to see how that turns out.
Yeah, I liked the sort of suggestive tone, which again, as you say, could be totally contextualized for the trailer and find it's not really there. This sort of notion of him having sort of a mandate almost, and potentially being a darker one.
I was just going to say, I'm curious why they're going into that new Star Trek movie.
Into darkness. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Moffat likes his Star Trek, but come on.
I must admit, but that was more interesting to me than the plethora of weird, strange creatures, which I've learned doesn't interest me much because they either are going to be good or they're not. You can never tell from the visual appearance of whether they're going to be an interesting story or not. So that doesn't really touch me. Apart from dinosaurs on a planet, it seemed a bit soon after having them on a space spaceship, but, you know, whatever.
Well, it was London, wasn't it? It's a bit dinosaur invasion, so that's exciting. Invasion of the Dinosaurs style.
It would be if we hadn't already had Invasion of the Dinosaurs in London.
Well, it was, you know, 40 years ago.
Not for me. I saw it 2 months ago on my DVD.
Okay, fair enough. So this week we're going to be a little bit looser than normal basically this week, aren't we? On account of the French diet we've been enjoying today on Bastille Day, and so toilet humour there for you, dear listener. Every week on Casteris.com. So James and I were talking earlier about security, weren't we?
We were,
and we're not going to go too much into this because there's a few things that we can't really share, but it has come to light. And it's been reported on a couple of sites on the internet that the leak that you all know about, because, you know, Deep Breath is available on the torrent sites to download. The five scripts for the first five episodes are also available on torrent sites. The second episode may also be available on torrent sites. And they were leaked. Now, you know, there's this one guy who's getting the blame for it because his name was all over the scripts. I think we can pretty much rule him out as the cause of the leaks, based on his what he does for a living and the fact that he probably wouldn't put his name all over the documents if he was leaking them. One would hope, because he's completely inept. There was this story going around that it was a Dropbox folder that was hacked. The evidence at the moment apparently is pointing more towards a similar sort of setup, a cloud storage situation, but not Dropbox. In fact, it turns out that it was completely insecure, or unsecured even.
It was insecure. Very insecure. About, it was insecure, good reason too.
Of being hacked.
All its fears were realised.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Now this changes things considerably, doesn't it? Because we're not talking about someone who's hacking things. We're talking about someone who's basically using the internet to view web pages.
I think we're talking about something even slightly worse, because unfortunately for a little bit, this story fell onto the ownership of the BBC being the victim to something which was malicious, potentially, if it was true, malicious and targeted.
Yes.
Now it sort of suggests my hypothesis on this would be that there is possibly someone on the inside who has either themselves or has given information out which has led to the location. So it would have been undisclosed, it would have been an unsecured location, but it would be a private one that you wouldn't know where to find unless you knew where to find it. So it makes me wonder if some that simple data, which you wouldn't normally have, was disclosed.
Yeah.
That allowed people to get to it. And that in itself, so the story sort of almost again swivels back to the BBC, doesn't it? And sort of says, you know, and from what I've heard, there's a lot of anger being in the BBC over it from various areas for various reasons. Because, I mean, this is deeply frustrating, embarrassing, and, you know, arguably incompetent. I mean, okay, all you needed was for someone to accidentally release or intentionally release that URL to whoever it was, or that location, and you've got a massive breach.
Yeah, we're essentially talking about a HTTP folder.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, websites are comprised of HTTP folders, but they usually have an index.html or an index.php or whatever, which displays the web page as you would recognize it, dear reader. All that would have been required is a single URL. You, listener, you could have done this, basically. That's how simple it was, apparently, to have got hold of these documents and videos.
But I think what this creates is a very interesting topic, and I was just talking to a journalist friend of mine before we came on air here about this, is the question of the balance between the strength of social media and social interaction versus professionalism within an industry, and how those two things are sort of becoming very merged. I mean, if you take back into the 1940s or 1950s, the entertainment medium was a very professional medium in the sense that you were there because you're a professional, not because you're a fan. Now you've got a situation where you have entire makeups of productions filled with fans of the legacy of not just necessarily of television, but of those products. And so you open yourself up to the fear of very strong security breaches.
Mm.
Because all you need is someone on the inside who is a fan loving to chat to a fan on the outside, and for something to release or something to be coaxed out. And you've got an immediate breach, which you wouldn't have if they were just there as professionals and didn't really give a damn about fans on the outside or people on the outside, you know, unless they were particularly corrupt or after money or something. So there is a big problem here, and it's a big problem for the BBC because it seems to keep happening. And yeah, I have a horrible feeling this is part and parcel of it. It's, you've got a weakness because people on the inside are malleable to want to talk or want to disclose because they're fans.
Yeah. What do you think about it, Brian?
I don't know. I'm just surprised, you know, that after all the years that this has happened to them, that they haven't been, like, taking fail-safes everywhere. To leave something like this so open just seems so ridiculous.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I don't really know what to think about. I mean, definitely it's going to be hard, no matter what you're doing in this world, to try and keep a secret when people have a vested interest in it working among you, you know? I mean, even all the way up, you know, take a few years ago with David Tennant and now with Peter Capaldi being fans of the show, you know, they're in there and they're just as hyped as we are. Granted, they're not going to leak things because of how important it is to them to keep the secrets and have people see their things fresh and new. But somebody working in there as a script editor or even just a gopher, you know, what they see is free game to them because they feel like a kid in a candy store. So I think it's going to happen no matter what they try and do. It's just surprising that a leak like this one was so blatant. I mean, it's ridiculous how easy that was, or how much people got this time around, how easy it was for that to happen.
But I mean, at the same time, I mean, you've got the journalism syndrome, where journalists will, by nature, get close to sources for information that they can use, and if they're good journalists, they will use it appropriately. But you know, the rapport there is because they are after data, you know, and this is entirely legitimate. This isn't talking about corrupt journalism. It's about taking people out to lunch, having a chat to them, having them relax, and having them talk to you about stuff and give you information. And then, as I say, if you're a good journalist, you'll make sure that it's information they're comfortable with divulging. But the point being is that when you've got people on the inside who are fans, I think that is where the danger becomes, because they are far more likely to release stuff without possibly even realizing it. Now, I think in this case, if there was an insider, they did realize it, because I think it's very hard to accidentally slip an HTTP address into a conversation. It's not like accidentally saying that Charles Dance is on Doctor Who, he's on the set at the moment or something, you know, that you can almost forgive. But to actually, this feels a lot, little more considered. But I think it's a big problem, I don't know where it's going to go. Because it's not just about Doctor Who, this is about the strength of social media, the strength of the media. I mean, you look at The Guardian. The Guardian will, on every day at the moment, have something about Doctor Who on there. They've got a fan reporting on the trailer, what they thought of the trailer. You think, is that really international news? It's clickbait. It's because there's a lot of people who will click that because it's easy. So while you've got that sort of interest in this sort of stuff, you're going to get people on the inside, I think, more likely to, are going to be more vulnerable to actually letting stuff out. Not sometimes not even realizing they might even be being manipulated. I think
the interesting thing too is if this were Doctor Who in the 80s, let's say, and this technology was around then to be able to leak information like this then, who would have cared aside from just a handful of fans? You know what I mean? Not to downplay Doctor Who in the 80s, but it certainly was nothing like it was today. You know, it has a lot to do, obviously, with the high-profile nature of the show, but it's also surprising with all these other high-profile shows that are out there right now, think things like Game of Thrones, this isn't happening.
Yeah.
And why is that? You know, what is it about Doctor Who fans that make them, like, crawl out of the woodwork and get into places that they shouldn't be getting into and get this information released? You know?
Well, maybe to a certain degree it's because shows and productions like Game of Thrones have a far tighter system. Maybe there is an argument that the BBC still hasn't quite caught up, and there is enough chinks in the armor to allow this sort of thing to happen. Because there's no way that those should have been ever in, you know, because they're BBC franchise material. They're pretty much gold. They're wanted all around the world. There's no way they should have been, if it's true, in an unsecured location on the internet. That should never have happened, even though the chances of someone finding that were probably so slim that people didn't particularly think about it. That should never have been a case to allow this to happen. And I think that's the sort of problem, maybe, is that there's just not quite enough professionalism within, or maybe the fact there's too many artisan connections to Doctor Who. I mean, there's a lot of, I'm not bagging on the restoration team, but you know, the restoration team was largely made up of artisans who had a love of Doctor Who, and they did great jobs for the DVDs. But what I'm saying from a professional point of view is that when you've got fans sort of employed to do stuff for you, maybe that also creates potential chinks in your armor. And again, as I say, I'm not talking about restoration team specifically, I'm talking about the setup of having fans and artisans involved in such a media focused event as Doctor Who. Maybe that's why Doctor Who suffers and Game of Thrones doesn't. I don't know.
It's a possibility.
I think it's a shame if that is the case, because I think it's great that you get fans involved like this. And, you know, fans can be such a fantastic investment for the show because they have such focus. And the restoration team is an perfect example of that. You know, the focus and intensity that was worked upon those DVDs was a love, wasn't it? And then, as you said, Peter Capaldi, you've got Stephen Moffat is a fantastic example, as is Davis, Gatiss as well. You know, people who grew up with Doctor Who, absorbed it, loved it, and are now there producing it and creating it. So it's not to say, in a sense, it's a shame, because I think having fans involved can be extremely enriching, can't it? It's just, I don't know, I suppose, is it too big to just let fans go in unless they're utter professionals? I don't know.
At the same time, too, just putting some security on that file would have made a world of difference. You know, it makes sense in this world of technology that, you know, to send a video to somebody who's still going to add sound effects or music to it makes sense. You're going to use Dropbox. You're going to use some kind of feature like that. That's why they were originally created, for people who do work like this to send large files back and forth. But just having some kind of password protection on it of some sort would have made a world of good. And we wouldn't be having this right now. Maybe there wouldn't actually be a major leak. Because really, what other leaks did we have aside from people who were on outside locations taking photos, you know, with their telephoto cameras? You know, I mean, there wasn't anything. And this just seems like something that someone should have thought of. And why that didn't happen.
It was avoidable.
Yes, absolutely. It was 100%
avoidable. How did the rose get leaked back in 2005?
That was a kind of a slightly similar situation. It was believed to have been a Canadian television VTR worker guy type of thing. You know, someone who had access to the disc.
Yeah, and that was the person directly going, "Hey, check it out. I'll upload it for you all to check it out." You know, rather than just somebody going, "Hey, I found this unsecure BBC site that either they were told of or just, you know, what luck just chanced upon it," you know. But yeah, it was a little bit more direct, that one, I think. Well, that we know of. This one could be equally as direct.
Yeah. Because I've got on both occasions, BBC have been accused of kind of faking it, haven't they, as well?
Yes, yes.
This is a bit much to fake, you know. Even with Rose, I can see why, you know, that might be good for faking it. You might get it out there, get people more hyped up, start telling other people to tune in and check it out, you know, kind of thing. But this is a bit much. This is 5 scripts and potentially 2 episodes. If they were going to leak something, I would think they would just try and replicate the situation and leak at least 1, you know, maybe 2. You know, I think this is a little bit more damaging than being some kind of gimmick for them.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting how this kind of dovetails into this other topic that's under discussion on Cast Service at the moment with regards to the BBC farming out production of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
One wonders whether if Doctor Who was produced by a different company, whether or not this scenario of leaks would have occurred. But then we have this big cultural kind of wall in the way saying, no, the BBC must produce Doctor Who. I'm going to come at James second. Brian, what do you think of that? Do you think the BBC is the only company that can produce Doctor Who?
Well, you know, even though it's a bit of a controversial answer, we've already seen that another company could with the American TV movie that you and I seem to like. And while it did have its flaws, it's proof that it can be produced and can be done well. Certainly it could have been done better. But that said, you know, I'm surprised to hear it just because aren't they worrying is the wrong word, but they're two TV stations against each other. Can't find the right word for it. Excuse me. You know, it just kind of seems like a bit of an, thank you, rivals. My God, why was that not there?
Yeah.
It just seems like a little bit of an odd thing. But, you know, how to say this? It makes sense to keep it with the BBC because they have a nice vested interest in it, of course, as do we, the fans. But if somebody's going to make it and make it right and still continue to tell good stories, I'm for that. That said, I don't know what ITV is like. And if they're going to make it at all like the way our TV works here, because I know some of your channels do it where they have commercials, I don't want that. It's kind of an odd thing, but I like watching Doctor Who as if it's a movie every week.
Well, in the UK, over the last kind of 20 to 30 years, say call it 30 years, 25 years certainly, our TV industry has been slowly deconstructed down from being a kind of a two-tier behemoth where both tiers, the two rivals, make their own TV shows and screen the occasional import. With the exception on ITV side of the ITC stuff. Nowadays it's more of, certainly for ITV and more recently for the BBC, they've been moving towards the model of production companies, they're commissioning production companies. So the arrangement here, which has been suggested by Tony Hall, who's the BBC's Director General, is that the BBC would commission ITV to produce Doctor Who, and then it would still be aired on the BBC, so there would be no ad breaks or anything like that. Sherlock is made by Hartswood Films, which is a company owned by Stephen Moffat. There's the Midsummer Murders, for instance, that's produced independently of ITV. So there's like 2 examples for you. James, how are you feeling about this today?
Well, I personally, I still think the likelihood would be, and I've been talking to someone else about this, that it would go to BBC Worldwide and it would go outside. I don't think, I don't think they are, I think there would be too much for a PR cry, even though I don't think it would make a horrendous amount of difference.
No.
I think there would be, like with the Canadian, there would be a very large BBC influence in it, because BBC, it is a BBC mascot, I suppose. But I think more likely, and I've heard as a possible prospect, would be go to BBC Worldwide, which makes a lot of money from Doctor Who, as we all know.
It makes a lot of sense to do that as well, doesn't it?
Makes far more money than it costs to make Doctor Who. So quite frankly, if there was anyone who really should be making Doctor Who, it should be BBC Worldwide. And that would keep it nicely in the BBC umbrella, which would be good for them. It would be good for the fact that, you know, publicity-wise, or the storm of people getting upset over it going to ITV, even though it's technically not going to ITV, you know, and all that sort of stuff. I think it would go to, if they farm it out. And I think there's good reasons for this, because as someone said, the other factor is even if they don't start farming everything out to other companies, to other places, you still got an issue that the BBC has a mandate as it is now to be commissioning programs what private companies, private networks can't do, because they are commercially run. They can't afford to take those risks. BBC is meant to take certain risks as part of its commission. And when you've got something as massive as Doctor Who, there is a sort of argument that they tend to sort of say, well, we've got our science fiction, we've got Doctor Who. And it sort of might be inadvertently a bit of a floodgate to stop other science fiction being made when so much money goes to Doctor Who. So if it was farmed out to BBC Worldwide, it might open the doors, you know, as things are now, for other shows to sort of money looser available for other sort of shows of similar ilk or different ilks. So I think there's a good argument that it should go to BBC Worldwide wherever the BBC goes in its future.
Yeah.
Approach to making shows.
It does seem to make an awful lot of sense that BBC Worldwide should be the producers. And what a contrast to 21 years ago, when BBC Worldwide screwed up the production of The Dark Dimension, which was struck down due to a budgeting error. I mean, that just wouldn't happen now, would it? Even if there was a budgeting error, they'd still do it.
Mm.
Madness. Yeah. Madness. Okay, BBC Worldwide. Does anyone have anything to add to this? Because we've got a
related
story.
No, I'm good.
The World Tour. Brian, how are you feeling about the Doctor Who World Tour? Are you interested in attending?
I'd like to check
local
it out,
event?
Yeah.
What's in your neck of the woods?
Well, I don't know what they're doing exactly, but I know they're going to New York, but I don't know the full details yet. I'm still trying to figure out if I'm able to go to it, but I would like to go to it if I can.
Okay. If anyone from BBC Worldwide is listening.
Right, there you go.
And isn't angry that we've told everyone that they should be spending money on Doctor Who.
You just had to bring that up again. Good. No, it was a lot of fun going to the Asylum of the Daleks premiere. Just you know, and for the most part, it would be really nice, obviously, to meet the stars again. That would be great fun. But a lot of the fun was actually hanging out with the fans, getting to make new friends, meet new people that were interested in the show, and just seeing the excitement level of everybody at an event like this.
We're still not talking about you bedding Karen Gillan, then?
No, well, there's no chance of that right now, is there? She's not going to be there, Christian.
No, I mean last time when you met her.
Oh, yeah, we don't talk about that.
Okay, right, sorry.
Oh, I'm kind of glad, because I could imagine a lawyer coming over very soon to set things straight, and maybe your girlfriend as well.
Yeah, that would be more likely, I think. and that would be bad, James. No, it would
Thanks
be a lot of fun.
Thanks for the clarification.
But like I said, I don't know much about it. New York is, you know, I'm actually, to be honest, I'm very surprised that, number one, there's only one U.S. city on. I would have thought that they would have done LA and New York.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised that they chose New York over LA. And I'm glad to see that, because obviously it's much easier for me to get to. So it'll be a lot more fun
to get to as well.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, they seem with like San Diego Comic-Con and so on. That they were all about that for a little while. And then, of course, it seemed like there were quite a few events more recently in New York. And I don't know if they just tend to like New York better or find it just easier. I don't know. But it seems like it's a good place for them to be.
Well, Titan are looking after kind of flying the flag for Doctor Who, aren't they, at San Diego Comic Con?
Yes.
It's I've got an email from them this morning. There's a lot of stuff going on. But basically, that you know, there's no famous people. There. We're just talking comic book writers for San Diego Comic Con. And if I can just bring it up, because I know they've got an off... I mean, they're going all out. They've even got an off-site event. There's variant covers available for the 11th Doctor and the 10th Doctor books series. There's signings on Friday the 25th of July. There's Doctor Who Comics Day on the July the 26th, which is when the both comic series are released. I think I'm right in saying. And there's a Doctor Who Comics panel as well that day at the San Diego Comic Con, and more signings. And then the off-site event is also the same day. And that's it as far as Doctor Who is concerned at Comic Con. There's no trailers at Comic Con based on this, unless, you know, Stephen Moffat turns up at the last minute with a film reel under his arm. I'm not seeing that happening, to be honest with you, this time round. Now, Australia's also... They're...
Unless he's downloaded it off the internet.
Yes! Well, he won't need the film reel, will he? He can just download it to his laptop, yeah.
That's why it happened.
Yes. And the Dwell Tour is also hitting Australia. It has been announced today. We're recording this, as usual, on Monday. The Doctor Who World Tour will see Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman circumnavigate the globe, apparently. They're using traditional means of transport, as in the famous story Around the World in 80 Days. So they'll be using elephants and camels and balloons to reach Australia. So you can expect them there next year. They'll be visiting 7 cities across 5 continents in 12 days. So perhaps they're actually using a TARDIS. It kicks off in Cardiff on August the 7th, then heads to London on the same day, I believe. Then off to Seoul in South Korea, Sydney, New York, Mexico City, obviously following the footsteps of Mark Gatiss's recent South American tour. I know Mexico is not in South America. They're off to Rio de Janeiro on August the 19th in Brazil to finish off. So it's quite a big tour, but it's not really circumnavigating, is it? I don't know. I suppose it is. Well, no, it's not, because they're not coming back to the UK. I mean, they are coming back to the UK at the end, but obviously, but there isn't an event in the UK at the end, so that isn't a circumnavigation. Sorry. Just wanted to be pedantic about that particular issue.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah, okay, good. I thought you might be. So, that's the Doctor Who World Tour. I would love to go to one of the events, but I haven't been invited. So there you go.
Nor have I. No. We can.
To be honest with you, I would probably have sent you anyway, because you're closer.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be a dog's body.
Oh, you've been talking to your butler again, have you?
Yes. He'd be very pleased to see me learning the hardships of having to be do as I'm told.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got nowhere to go with that, I'm afraid.
No, good. okay. So, there is one other thing I want to talk. Does anyone have anything they want to talk about before we move on to recommendations?
There should be, because there's a few things this week, and I can't think of any.
While
of them.
You're thinking, I want to raise a brief eulogy to Comic Heroes from Future Publishing. And following this, I will probably go into a small rant about publishing in the UK, so do bear with me.
Okay.
Comic Heroes is from Future Publishing. It's largely the same team that produced SFX, and it's about comic books and comic book movies. You'll be surprised, actually. It's largely about the comic books themselves rather than the movie adaptations and the various movie series that are out there. Now, Doctor Who Link is that in this month's issue, or this quarter's issue, there is a feature on Titan's Doctor Who series that's coming along, all three series, the 11th Doctor, the 10th Doctor, and the 12th Doctor series. The 12th Doctor series kicks off in March. In October. I'm not going to go into any details about this because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I haven't read it yet. And secondly, there's more important things to talk about, and that is the fact that Comic Heroes has been axed after 24 issues, which is it's a big shame. It's been going since 2010. The magazine industry's changed slightly since 2010, and but more importantly is the fact that Future Publishing has recently been bought by a publishing company, and they're basically changing the model. So the vast majority, and we're talking something like 90-95% of magazines from Future Publishing is dispensing, in fact, I'm going to rephrase that, 95%-100% of magazines are dispensing with freelancers, which means the vast majority of content in their magazines, in their output from kind of around, I would say around September, October time this year, is going to be press, rewritten press releases, marketing material. There's going to be no independent original journalism, which is a massive shame. Mm. Massive shame. And how, I mean, I know, you can see how it might work for a computer-related magazine or a consumer electronics magazine or perhaps, you know, like fashion magazines, that kind of thing. How it's going to work for SFX, God only knows. Which is one of the, we should be fortunate, we should think ourselves fortunate, however, because it wasn't so long ago that Future were said to be one of the most likely beneficiaries of buying Doctor Who magazine. Now, if that had happened, Doctor Who magazine would be in a massive load of trouble. So that, at least, is a silver lining. James, sorry.
I was just going to say, I mean, the problem really is, isn't it, is the truth that the publication, you know, numbers are dropping, circulation is dropping.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, there's a horrid truth that if we're upset about the drop in quality in our in journalism to a horrible degree, we've only got ourselves to blame. I was talking to a friend about this the other day. You know, looking at, I don't want to name and shame, but looking at some of the articles on the Independent website, and you know, so much of it is just clickbait. I mean, the top end article was fairly interesting in its idea, was there might be a new shade of black that we can't see. And you think, well, that tops Gaza and it tops, you know, political issues in at home. That's the top. And it is clickbait. And you sort of say, well, this is terrible. And I remember David Simon saying how over in the States, and it'll be the same here, how newspapers with the circulation declining can't afford to do investigative journalism anymore. So, and you take online, you know, we're talking, looking at the Mail and the Mirror and the tabloids like that, how much of that is aggregates? Aggregate fillers. It's not, there's very little investigative journalism. You know, Guardian is possibly one of the most famous of late to be still doing it.
Yeah but then again, they had to do it in conjunction with another newspaper, didn't they?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, they do actually have them on staff. But it's not like, you know, it used to be, where investigation. But we're not paying for it.
No.
All we're paying for at the moment, majority of us are paying for, is through advertising revenue through websites. We're not buying newspapers anymore, and magazines, and that is the problem, isn't it? Yeah. So we're going to see a drop off for freelancing, and it's a shame.
What I'm worried about is this having a knock on effect, because Future's big rival in the UK is Imagine Publishing, and I do quite a bit of freelancing for one or two of their publications. Now, my hope is that the Future situation kind of collapses, and not in a bad way. I don't think we'll lose our jobs. It's probably going to happen, but you know, it has a bad impact, and no one follows suit. But if it does work for them, then other companies are likely to follow suit.
Yeah.
Which again going to lead to job losses. It's already leading to like freelancers being out of work. So
the terrifying thing is, you know, in theory, good freelancers will find work.
Yes.
Via the internet and the like, and hopefully that will, you know, advertising revenue will make sure that they can be paid properly. But it does mean again that the sort of articles that you're going to get, you know, your people are going to lose quality. Journalism is going to lose its quality. It's not necessarily just going to be like it's a straight change over to a different medium.
No.
Especially when you've got the technology for aggregation and the fact that people are more likely to click aggregate stuff, you've got a real problem, I think, anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so that's just a little detour. Comic Heroes is out now in shops. I mean, it's worth buying just for the quality of the magazine. You know, we're talking, how many pages is that, too? 162 pages. It's always a brilliant read. It's beautifully written. The features are always marvellous. And it's the last issue, so you might as well buy it. And it must have come very late because there's only two mentions of it being the last issue. There's no sort of like endless editorial. There's a little notice in the credit section which says, thanks for reading for the last 24 issues. And then a thing on the inside, back cover, 2010 to 2014, thank you for reading. So that's a bit of a shame. But, you know, it's got Doctor Who feature in there as well, so buy it. Okay, James, you were edging towards talking about something a few moments before I launched into that rant.
Was I?
Yes. You said you were.
Well, I've Fortunately, you interested me, so I forgot.
Oh, good.
it's a double-edged sword, that. Yes.
It's a difficult thing. Brian, have you any thoughts on magazines collapsing or closing?
No, you know, I'm so far removed from those things anymore. I used to really enjoy Doctor Who magazine, and then I think I've talked about this on here before. Like they for a while, their articles just became about let's make fun of the classic series and praise the new series
rather
than be objective and interesting. And then I hear they've gone back to that, but I just I haven't bothered to pick them up again. But they were really the only one that I did pick up. So I don't know of any others out there. So I haven't read them for many years now, at least 4 years now.
Okay.
Well, sure. So yeah, I mean, I don't want them to stop. It was a magazine, and people really enjoy it. Just for me, I haven't missed it in my life. I guess when it went downhill for me. But if they picked up, you know, I might pick one up and check them out again, I guess. But I don't know if I would do a subscription again.
Okay.
Something we should perhaps mention, going back to the trailer, since I think majority of people listening to this podcast will be listening to it because of the trailer.
Yes.
What did you think of the console room slight augmentations and colours?
Oh, well, I like the rotating light. I think there's a lot. I mean, this maybe is reflecting, maybe hopefully, the theme of what we're going to be seeing over the coming when it starts. Because you may know, James and Brian, and dear listener, you should perhaps know by now that I took a load of screen grabs from it, which I do using a piece of software, so I don't have to keep pressing the button. So I basically captured every frame using the KM player. So I was able to see, as I went through and selected, I think I selected 49 or 50 in the end from it, I could see one of the moments when we see the Doctor, we see the lights in the TARDIS behind him, going past him on the TARDIS wall from behind him, and then presumably coming back behind the camera view, and we see the lighting change on the Doctor's face, and then the light comes back round again. So that appears, I'm hoping, that's some kind of evidence that the TARDIS is in flight. That's the thing that goes on.
That, do you know, was otherwise? In Smith's console, though.
Did it?
Yeah, that was there.
Right. Well, maybe it's the general lighting and the changes that they've made to it that makes it more stand out more.
I do agree, though. I think it would be nice if it was like indicative of TARDIS in flight, and I think that's when it was used. But I agree. I do like that. I think that's a nice looking feature.
Yeah, James?
Probably more prominent in the shot that they chose, actually. Perhaps. It was one thing that really stood out to me in that shot, and it was a beautiful shot.
Yeah. James, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting colour scheme. I think is there now bookshelves on the top on the top level?
Is
it looks like there's books now.
That'd be interesting.
Now,
yeah,
lining,
I hear people mentioning that. Yeah,
lining the top level, the top tier, which is an interesting touch. I mean, obviously they've tried to make it look more warm. There is a little, I could argue, and I don't mean this in a detrimental way, a little bit of the golds and the reds, a little like circus. And he's got us almost like a ring master sort of purple tight top on. There could be an almost that sort of colour scheme they're going for.
Right.
Sort of like a big top. I don't know. It's a nice... I like it. I think I can understand what people were saying, that they found that the original lighting was a little too cold, which it was meant to be, obviously.
Yeah.
So
I think what it was for me was it was a grey console room, which looks really beautiful. It's a very nice console room, but the blue lighting didn't help enhance that. It was kind of like in 2005 when the Smith console room came out and everything was far too orange. It was hard to actually look at it, in my opinion.
2010.
Yes, 2010. Yeah. with this one, changing it to the orange lights, I think it's a nice contrast. I think it helps enhance the room. Two things that I noticed for me. I like all the changes. I think it looks beautiful.
I think
really
I found the library, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Nice. Post that up.
I will do. Yes.
But I was hoping. I'm not a big fan of the gears spinning at the top of the console room. I think they would just look better if they were stationary and if the central rotor actually still had the up and down motion, which I know in a few shots in Smith's era, we've seen like a piston in the center of it move up and down. But I like that motion, but I do like at least that the lights do something in the rotor. I mean, it does look nice, but aside from
The rotor broke, which is why it no longer does that. It no longer has the up down of the crystals. Only one moves because they damaged the system. So I'll be interested to see if they repaired that.
Yeah, it would be nice if they repaired that. It's a nice look. But no, I'm a big fan. I think it looks really nice. I think the shots that they showed in the trailer really showed it off well, especially the one Christian had brought up, because I noticed that as well, that those lights are really neat. It's just a great effect. It's like it's kind of silly, but it's almost like the Doctor is in his own discotheque. but no, it's a neat thing, though.
It'll be interesting to see if they actually use those bookshelves. In the sense, one thing I did like in the McGann movie was the feeling that this guy spends a lot of time in the console room.
Mm.
So he's decided to have a lot of stuff there to entertain him.
It's like he broke down the walls, isn't it? Maybe something happened in the Seventh Doctor era where the TARDIS misbehaved and he couldn't get back to the console room quick enough from one of his rooms. So, sod this, I'm just knocking down all the walls and having everything here.
Well, I mean, there's a logic to it, because he is a character who gets bored very quickly. Every incarnation's got that. He doesn't like sitting still. So you would think that if he was having to spend a lot of time in a console room, he would have books and stuff. So I'd be interested to see whether they use that at all, in the fact that he might ever see him sitting with a book or sitting up there looking at the books. Or will they just be totally decorative in a sense where they don't really play anything more than a background aesthetic? Something totally off the point. I was thinking the other day, I was watching Day of the Doctor on iPlayer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that bit where you see all the other doctors. And, you know, one of the problems is that it's very clearly montages of bits from the from previous Doctor Who episodes, and the same with the
bits. That doesn't really matter, though, does it? Because they could quite easily have just been doing that little thing, just something pops up on the TARDIS console, so do this Doctor from the Doctor. Oh, it's timey-wimey, I'll do this.
No, that's what I was just about to say. In a sense, sorry. That's still kind of work. Yeah, you spoilt it. Fine. I
apologise.
Was that just that thought that maybe, you know, at that moment when you watch... damn it, why is it sometimes that names... Parting of the Ways, with the "I'm for my next trick," and he pulls that lever, you think, oh, that's a dematerialisation, when in fact it isn't. It's just through his telepathy at that point... He is actually doing something else at that moment, which is relative to Gallifrey later on. It could be things like that, that it's not so cut and dry as people think. You know, you see the exteriors all going around Gallifrey, but inside them, they could still be part of another story, in a sense. I don't know. There's just fun things about Doctor Who, which is probably why people are so insane about it.
Yes, you've probably hit it.
It's so malleable that you could just talk about it forever.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. Let's just, before we do on to recommendations, shall we talk about Stephen Moffat and Star Wars?
Okay, oh yes, there is.
Because that was a big deal last week.
Surprisingly.
in which there was this rumour going around, and, you know, it's been debunked by Mrs. Moffat. She says that, just in case you've seen the rumours that Stephen Moffat is doing Star Wars, that's news to him. The rumour came from Jedi News, which is a respected Star Wars website, by all accounts. And they, for leaking genuine news, I should add there. And the suggestion was that Moffat was being linked to a future Star Wars project, either the third of the new trilogy or one of the standalone character movies. He's previously worked with Steven Spielberg on The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn, and one of the other producers on that film was one of the producers on the new Star Wars trilogy. So it's not, and obviously Spielberg and Lucas. I don't think it's unlikely that Stephen Moffat's probably met George Lucas, so I don't think this is pie in the sky. And, you know, we had some odd comments about this as well, which, Steve C. Moffat, the director of anything? Oh, do be serious. Have a look at his IMDb before reporting this sort of nonsense. Well, directors come from somewhere, don't they? Now, I'm not saying that Stephen Moffat is a movie director, but directors come from somewhere. So, what did you guys think of this story?
I don't think it's very likely. I mean, I do agree with you that the directors do come from somewhere, but it does feel like it feels like a story for the sense of clickbaiting. you know, Doctor Who's very much in the news, Star Wars is very much in the news. You can find connections between the two, as you have rightly pointed out. It's not so far removed that you couldn't think it would be impossible. I mean, he's had a lot of production experience. There's no reason why he couldn't consider looking at direction.
But again, that's only one option. The other options were writing and producing as well. So.
Well, absolutely. You know, and on both counts, I would never be entirely surprised if, you know, these new Star Wars series and Star Wars spin-offs, that maybe he would have an involvement. Whether it is right now, I don't know. I would take it with a pinch of salt, but it has enough ring of truth, doesn't it, that you wouldn't be surprised if you found out it was true.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, we know that he's a Star Trek fan, a sci-fi fan, so who's to say that he's not a Star Wars fan? And considering, like you said, the article did say possibly for the third one, and who, you know, I would think more in a writing capacity because that's what he does. But since he's been announced for being the producer of Doctor Who for Series 9, it does make sense that he could move on after that to this other contracted gig. You know, I mean, I'm not saying it's true or I believe it's true, but I see that there is some likely possibilities there because they may be looking for some established sci-fi writers that are doing very well to make these series very well.
Yeah, I mean, he's won several Hugo Awards, hasn't he? So
exactly. So it seems like there's plenty of merit there for it. And if somebody creates a deal like this that you're not supposed to talk about, obviously everybody's going to say you don't know anything about it. So I think it's a possibility. You know, whether I believe it or not, I don't know, but I can understand it certainly.
The direction thing. I mean, I'm still not convinced that he couldn't do it. I consider Stephen Moffat, certainly since he's becoming the honcho of Doctor Who, to be edging towards auteur. There's a particular relationship that he has with his work and his characters and the characters that he adds into the Doctor universe. And, you know, I mean, obviously he could give himself a director's job, one might think. So that's one thing against it. But I just, the way he treats Doctor and the way he relates with what he's creating seems to be slightly more intense than perhaps Russell T. Davies.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, Russell T. Davies, I mean, he's also been linked to Star Wars in the past, one of the cartoon series, which he turned down apparently.
Well, it's as I say, yeah, interesting, but
indeed.
Especially when he's got, you know, in the near future, he's still obviously very focused on Sherlock and Doctor Who. You know, Star Wars being a major franchise, of course, there is quite a few leaks in Star Wars at the moment, so you know. Maybe he'd be suited. Meow.
A few broken doors as well.
Meow.
And feet.
Oh, yes.
Indeed. Ah, yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you picked that one up.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to the recommendations?
Why not?
Sure.
James, you first.
I don't really have any, really. All I can give an update on the legacy thing that I've been talking about.
Oh, go on then. Do that, yes.
I had an email on Thursday saying, you know, sorry, we've not got back to you. We'll just check up, see what's going on. We're a bit backlogged at the moment. Nothing since then.
Right.
So,
did you reply to them?
Well, no, because they said they were backlogged and they were. I sent a reply saying, well, you've just had an update and a patch. I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate that. Though I think I'm going to have to send another message today. In the end, you know, to a certain degree, I'm not that bothered now. You know, I've not been playing it for a couple of weeks.
You're not that bothered, but you keep mentioning it on the podcast.
Well, that's my point. The point, because I brought it up initially, it seems unfair to now
I agree. Forget it without
a resolution one way or the other. I mean, if they come back and say there's nothing we can do, that's fine. And I will let people know that. But I want to give, after sort of bringing up this issue, I want to give the option of them being able to find a positive or find, you know, a resolution of some sort. So a closure. So I guess what I'm after.
Okay.
So, yes.
So, Doctor Legacy, please give James closure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were saying you had the same problem, didn't you? I mean, mine's on an Amazon platform. But
well, this was a long time ago. This was shortly after it first launched that I lost mine. So I wasn't that bothered because I hadn't at that point got that far through it. So it was a slightly different situation. But I mean, I agree. It's absolutely frustrating when it happens.
Yeah, that's it. And I just really want to now know where I think my issue at the moment is we know it happens. We know it's a problem. I don't yet feel that it's being acknowledged yet. And I really think it should, on behalf of people playing it, rather than for myself, if that makes sense. It makes me sound like a bit of a crusader, and I don't want to be that. But I kind of think it needs to be something. No, but I do have Julian Glover at my side.
Okay, fair enough then.
Yeah. So yeah, I would like to see. I'd like to see resolution, just so everyone knows that it's sorted. They're aware of it, and it can be handled or warned upon. But anyway, so what else? What have you got?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Well, I've got two things. First of all, I'm not sure if I mentioned. Have I spoken to you about Batman 1966? Have I mentioned this?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, it's a comic series, and it's based on the old TV show. So,
oh, right.
It's got none of this Dark Knight angst, and there's no kind of Christian Bale trying to talk without moving his mouth or anything like that. It's based on Adam West and the other guy.
Kurtwood.
Thank you. And you know, the old Batman car and Cesar Romero as the Joker and all that. It's absolutely marvellous. It's just lots of fun. There's nothing. It's not trying to be a movie. It's not trying to, you know, it's not trying to be a gritty action thriller. It's just being what a vast number of people think of as Batman, and it's lots and lots of fun. I imagine it's out in print. I read it on Comixology. Mm-hmm. I got some free credit when Amazon purchased Comixology a few weeks back, so I spent it on that and the Transformers Generation 1 series as well. But I would recommend, if you can pick up a copy of Batman 96 and read it, it's brilliant. My other recommendation is it's Bastille Day, so watch The Reign of Terror.
Can you do the Christian Bale voice again, please?
Yeah, you're in bed, man.
Christian Bale, not Marlon Brando.
Sorry. Whoa, no, that's Batman Boyle.
And
that was great.
Tom Jones.
I want that to be our intro from now on to the podcast series. Just do your, quote, Christian Bale impersonation every time.
Is it that bad?
It is pretty bad.
It's not Christian Bale. I'll tell you that.
We'll let the listener decide on that.
Yeah, there you go.
Unless, please, let us know what you think. Bale, in which case, yes. I'm going to have my face rearranged.
So what about you, Brian?
What about me? Well, I actually, like you, I don't really have much new to recommend this week, because I've still been continuing my rewatch of Stargate. But I do have something I want to bring up and recommend to many people, going back into Doctor Who's kind of fairly recent history. And probably it's going to be more relevant for American viewers. That said, it would work for any new viewer to the show as well. And that's going to be the 2005 Children in Need special post-regeneration scene with David Tennant and Billy Piper. And the reason I bring it up is because recently I've met quite a few people here in the U.S. Who still aren't aware of it. And when I talk about it with them, they do mention how jarring it was to get to the Christmas invasion and have things be so vastly different from the end of Parting of the Ways, when David Tennant was perfectly okay and happy and going to Barcelona, but then the situation changes in the Christmas invasion. And I introduced a couple friends recently to it who, number one, loved it. They thought it was a great special, but number two, they were so happy that it filled in the gaps that they had had questioned at the time, that they were a little perplexed by. So I would recommend that anybody check that out. And one thing I even noticed is it's a little bit difficult for people to find, because the DVD rather foolishly put it in the extras section rather than right before the episode on the episode list, where I personally think it belongs, even though you'd think a lot of people would find that just by nature of checking the extras, but a lot of them aren't aware, because I think they check it out on Netflix and so on. But even if you go to the Internet Movie Database and you look at David Tennant's history of the work he's done, they list things like the other Children in Need special, Time Crash, and they also list Music of the Spheres, but they do not list the first one, the post-regeneration scene. It's not there. It's not in Doctor Who, and it's not separately listed as a Doctor Who thing that he has done like the others are. So just spreading the word out there, because I think it's a great scene. I think it bridges the gap, and I 100% can't thank Julie Gardner enough for recommending to Russell to write this to bridge that gap. I just think it's a very important scene, and I'm still amazed to this day that there are a lot of people who still have not seen it. And like I said, any new fan watching the show might not be aware of it, so I want to put the word out there to check it out. When series one ends, watch this Children in Need special before you watch series two, and that's it. That's my recommendation.
I think that recommendation brings us to the end of this week's Casteras podcast with a K. We hope you've enjoyed it. Do give us your feedback and comments in the various methods that we leave open to you. And obviously, if you have the opportunity to rate us on iTunes, that would help us enormously. Until next time, it's au revoir. That was a bit Peter Davison intonation there, wasn't it? What happened to my voice?